I'm delighted to have you all join with us this evening for the first program in our Independent Policy Forum for this new century. The Independent Policy Forum, as many of you may know, is a regular series of lectures, seminars, debates, and panel discussions featuring top scholars and policy analysts held here at the Independent Institute's Conference Center in Oakland, California. As many of you know, the Institute regularly sponsors programs such as this, along with many of the conference and media projects that we do, and the book and other publications programs that we sponsor. Our program tonight is entitled Freedom, Terror, and Falsehoods, Lessons from the 20th Century. Our speaker tonight is Dr. Robert Conquest, who will be speaking based on his widely acclaimed new book, Reflections on a Ravaged Century, which has been getting extremely good reviews. In fact, Bob was a little nervous that perhaps it's getting too good reviews. For those of you new to the Institute, there was information in the packets that you hopefully received when you registered. For those of you joining with us by C-SPAN, you may visit our website at www.independent.org for further information about our many projects and programs, including our journal, The Independent Review. This is the fall issue, which has been sold out, as I understand, on newsstands. The new issue that was just published has a special emphasis on Asia, which relates in part to the topics that will be addressed this evening. More specifically, the Independent Institute is a non-politicized, non-profit, academic public policy research organization, and we get involved in virtually any and all kinds of social and economic issues. The results, as I mentioned, are published as books, and the Institute is supported by foundations, businesses, civic organizations, and individuals. In your packets, you'll also find a schedule of upcoming events. Our next event for the Independent Policy Forum will be held on February 2nd. The program will be discussing saving the environment, and the question will be government friend or foe. The speakers will be Peter Huber, who is senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, and Michael D'Alessi, who is director of the Center for Private Conservation, as well as Thomas Graff from the Environmental Defense Fund, and Sally Fairfax from the University of California at Berkeley. The event after that will be held on February 15th, and the topic then will be the issue of global warming. The question then will be, is it scientific fact or not? The speaker will be Dr. Fred Singer, who's president of the Science and Environmental Policy Project. He's also first director of the U.S. Weather Satellite Service. For this evening, we are indeed privileged to have with us one of the great historians, authors, poets, and quite frankly, literary masters of the 20th century to reflect on the past 100 years. Many of us have seen discussions of the past century and the millennium, of course, in the media. As economic liberalization has expanded around the globe, freeing more and more people to choose their own paths and to work to improve their own lives, their own futures, this past century has experienced perhaps the most dramatic changes that we've seen in the history of mankind. Economic, social, and technological advances have made far more people than ever able to advance on an incredible scale. In fact, the scale is really going off the charts. But this century has also been the home of the greatest terrors of human history. It seems to me that it's interesting that some people have apparently lost sight of this fact, that little more than just 10 years ago, the Berlin Wall came down. Indeed, the single greatest event of the century, perhaps, has been the rise and fall of totalitarian regimes. The 20th century has indeed witnessed government-sponsored carnage on an unprecedented scale. We may indeed recoil in learning of the shootings at schools around the country, but nothing compares with the deliberate and wholesale slaughter of millions and millions of people in countries around the world. In the course of such horrors, literally billions of people have further lived under the yoke of oppression and economic and social devastation of the total state in many parts of the world. And furthermore, this astounding story is not over, as we have witnessed in recent years, the incredible genocides in Africa, in Indonesia, and many other countries. What made this era susceptible to genocide along the lines of Hitler's Final Solution, Stalin's Gulag, Mao's Great Leap Forward, Pol Pot's killing fields, and other atrocities? Could the answer lie in the rogue ideologies that have been so popular in certain intellectual circles, and not just in those countries, but also in the West? Ideologies that uphold the power of the state over the individual and the institutions of civil society. How can we understand the rise of such ideologies, and how can we predict the 20th century that we will not have a return to such destruction? For decades, many in the West refused to recognize the true nature of either what some have considered to be right and left-wing collectivism in Europe, Asia, and elsewhere. However, in the midst of this ignorance and intellectual fallacy, Robert Conquest's work, through his painstaking research and his many seminal books, began exposing the realities of statism. In so doing, Dr. Conquest's lonely pursuit of truth has proven that the power of ideas can indeed triumph over tyranny. Robert Conquest was born in Malvern, England, on July 15, 1917. He was educated at Winchester College, the University of Grenoble, and Oxford University, where he received his MA and Doctor of Literature. During World War II, Conquest served with the Oxfordshire and Buckinghamshire Light Infantry. He also served under Soviet command against the Nazis in Bulgaria in 1944. After the war, he joined the British Foreign Service and received postings in Bulgaria and New York, the latter as part of the British delegation to the United Nations, which of course was just forming at that time. Since 1956, Dr. Conquest has pursued virtually a full-time academic career. Congruent with the publication of books such as The Great Terror and The Harvest of Sorrow, he held positions at the London School of Economics, Columbia University, and the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He now resides in California, where he is a senior research fellow and scholar curator at the Hoover Institution, and deals with a Russian and East European collection. He also serves as an adjunct fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C., and is a member of the advisory board of Freedom House in New York City. In addition to his achievements as an historian, Dr. Conquest is also a respected poet and writer. He's been the literary editor of The Spectator magazine, and is a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature and the British Interplanetary Society. For instance, Nobel laureate Alexander Solzhenitsyn selected him to translate his book-length poem, Prussian Nights. And we're very privileged to have him as a member of the editorial board of advisors for our journal, The Independent Review. So I'm very pleased to introduce Dr. Robert Conquest.
Well, that was very kindly put. Unfortunately, you gave about half my speech already. but that's all right. There's always more to say on these subjects. The last time I spoke at your institute, you gave me very kindly gave me an award, and I didn't have to speak much because they had several people speaking for me, and they included both conservatives and others. And Czeslaw Milosz came down and he said to you, as I remember, I don't usually come to conservative institutions. I just come because I agree with Robert Conquest on certain points. And I'm not even sure I'm a conservative myself, to tell you the truth, David. But I think what does arise is there are a lot of people who we wouldn't call conservatives who nevertheless agree together on a great deal of what I shall be saying and a great deal of what I've been writing about the Soviet Union and elsewhere. One of them expressed it to me roughly as follows: with all our disagreements, we form a united front against nonsense. And I think that's true. Well, as David Thoreau said, the horrors of our time have been very remarkable. It was the Russian writer Vasily Grossman who put it in a slightly different way when he said that the power of the totalitarian, the violence of the totalitarian system, the extreme violence of the totalitarian systems, was able to crush the human spirit throughout whole continents. It wasn't merely killing people, it was crushing their independent thought. And that, of course, it's not simply lying, it is forcing you to believe and assert what you don't believe, not just lying to you, it's forcing the lie deep into your soul. And that, I think, was one of the main points of the ideologies. Now, I'm supposed to be, in a sense, talking about this century, but I was asked to, I don't know if you see the Los Angeles Times, they had a piece, people gave their opinions of the most neglected book of the century. And I put in, perhaps a bit strangely, Norman Cohn's The Pursuit of the Millennium, which is about the late 15th century, early 16th century millenarian sects in Germany and elsewhere. But he makes it perfectly clear that he is talking also about, and he says so, about Chinese and Russian communists. Because the first thing to ask about the totalitarian ideas, these destructive ideas which have wreaked massive horror in our century, is how did they spread? Who accepted them? And he describes the stratum that did accept them. Back in those days, it was a rather low-grade intelligentsia, people who'd somehow got a priestly education without becoming priests, odd dropouts from the gentry's younger sons, and among the poor, not the poor as such, but people who didn't fit in any particular category of poverty or anything else. And he makes the point that this is what the sort of intelligentsia, as it were, which is what accepted in China and Russia and elsewhere, the idea, the capital I idea. And the capital I idea then and now had the same basic notion that heaven can be constructed on earth, first. Secondly, I think that you merge your identity with the movement, with the party or the sect, whatever it happened to be. And thirdly, that you want it all at once. I think it's Kierkegaard who says somewhere that the two great faults in thinking these days, or in his century, are laziness and impatience. And I think these are the two things which mark the reception, not the actual taking on of the ideology, but the type of mind which is going to take on an ideology. Laziness, meaning not being unable to bother to cope with the complications of reality, try and get it all done in one smart fix. And impatience, have it now. And I think this is extremely important to try and get some feel for the sort of people who took on these ideologies. Now, the ideologies, you may say, are dead, but this mindset is not dead and still exists around the world. Now, in my book, after making these rather saddening remarks, we have to ask ourselves, how did we manage to avoid that? They didn't come to power in the West. And not what is more, the Western society proved both more, in the long run, both stronger and more effective, and in a general sense, more adjusted to the future than these alleged super-futurologists. Now, I think we ought to look at Western society from the point of view that it doesn't seek perfection, It's evolved for over 1,000 years in the English and Scottish and Swiss cases, at least, from tribal times, with a certain balance between various parts of society, often some oppressing others, but never accepting, except for very short periods, not enough to destroy the general feelings, never accepting that the executive can do what it likes, or that compromises mustn't be reached, and never looking forward to a century in the future. So if we can cope with our present problems, that's pretty good. You can't see very far into the future. You can see dim shapes a few years into the future. You can see dangers which must be coped with now, but you do not fall into utopia. And it didn't affect, the utopian dream did not affect anybody in real power in the West, either from people fighting for power from below or people imposing power from above. And that was meant, I think, by the open society in the historical sense. Now, how did the next thing was, who challenged this on a big scale and to some extent penetrated the Western mind? And of course, one first and still most powerful trend is Marxism. I mean, you may say that Marxism is dead in a sense. Intellectually, it's dead. I did remember writing a piece some years ago saying it's now only found in its pure form, like a spotted owl in a few enclaves in California. But nevertheless, its principles exist still. The principle of perfectionism and the principle of an enemy who must be destroyed before you get the perfect society, which was the other great center of all ideology. Now, basically, how did this all start? I think my way of looking at it is, you go back to John Locke, and here we have a guy who actually theorizes about the free society, the open society. But he's theorizing in a context which knows what he's talking about, and he takes for granted the semi-democratic, the semi-liberty and law society, which was already in existence. But when he was transferred to France, the French didn't know about that. They thought theory is all you need. What was taken for granted in England was simply omitted in France, and you've got the beginnings, the first roots of both Marxism and Nazism, in a sense, that you've got the idea that reason will triumph. Reason can tell us everything. You've got people like Condorcet, who was a mathematician, who thought, not unlike some writers nowadays, that you could probably, in the long run, predict society by theory, by mathematics, which I fear is a heresy still around these days in a different form. But so they produced the notion of the rational, the triumph of reason, a totally rational society. You remember Chesterton once said that a lunatic is a man who's lost everything except his reason. And this is the sort of thing you got in France. They came to power thinking that first of all, they represented the truth, reason, so everybody else was going against the light and became an enemy of the people, which is an invention of the French Revolution, the idea of the enemy of the people. And then they thought they had the answers. And of course this failed. And they, as a famous French writer put it, the excesses of the revolution were nothing but the tantrums of a disappointed child, one way of looking at it. But anyway, from France, they declared both for the people, the friend of the people, and the nation, one and indivisible. And so from them you get Marx, who took the people idea rather than the nation idea. And he provided, of course, the extra, science. I think it's difficult to remember now, or to think now, how extraordinary in, the, say, the 1840s and 50s, the extraordinary dynamic of the period, there was a huge industrial expansion. There were railways, there was science, there was biology, there were physics, there was archaeology, very importantly. There was an enormous boom in knowledge and power, economic power, and it did look as though somehow the future was in that. And I think if you look back on Marx now, it's extraordinary how, which I call temporarily parochial he is. He saw the industrial working class, he saw the steaming factories, and he thought this is the future. The working class is a special grade, unlike anybody else before, who will be the future, will take over, destroy the wicked, the capitalists, of course. And he looked forward to a vast area, vast industrialization. And I put it in the book, in one sense, the victory of the West in the Cold War is the victory of Silicon Valley over Magnitogorsk, because the Russians did produce, they went on investing in steel and coal. It was a sort of, old, what I find about Marxism is a sort of musty taste, musty smell about it. But in that sense, well, I don't want to simply develop an analysis of Marxism, though I'd have it in, have a chapter on its various faults. Its predictions all failed. And I think it's a good point to make that it's rather odd, an alleged great philosopher, great historian, great economist, that practically no philosophers or historians or economists have followed him. There are some, but not very many. The professionals don't. But we should trace, I think, before going on to the real excesses of Marxism, that the nationality side, which also derived from the French Revolution, and the original nationalist movements in Europe were usually of a Jacobin type, revolutionary in the old sense, and only eventually deteriorated into a more taken over by the German state and so on. But there again, the West, the Scottish and British, English and Swiss and so on, had an advantage, I think, over the French, not so much the French, but over some of the other countries in Europe, in that the nation evolved in somewhere like England. It wasn't created from above by the state or by agitators saying, hey, you're an Englishman. But this, and in countries of Eastern Europe, not of Eastern Europe particularly, the nationalities were, to some extent, the creation of the state and the intellectuals. They didn't have the settled downness, which would have been perhaps more useful in a historical sense. But nevertheless, a crucial moment came, of course, on the question of nationality, when Mussolini decided, who had been a Marxist, a left-wing Marxist, in fact, and who decided that the people must merge themselves, not with the masses, but with the nation. He switched. And fascism came, and later National Socialism, derived from that switch, the identification, again identification with a huge non-personal phenomenon, and a great social or ideological group, but a different, just changed direction. And it's very striking, incidentally, how many communists became fascists in the 30s and vice versa. There was a move. Hitler always said he could turn a communist into a Nazi, and he couldn't turn a social democrat into a Nazi. The wish to get absorbed in an ideology was there. And it just changed focus. Well, we at least lost Nazism some years ago, but that has not been the great international bane that communism has been. But I think one ought to say, before going on about what happened in Russia at all, one ought to say that nowadays, there, in many countries in the world, there is something like a national socialist regime. There is a ruler and a ruling party who are ruling, from people's point of view, to put down the bad rich and the wicked foreigner. you think for the dozen countries in the world that obviously applies to. So though National Socialism as a dogma has gone, a sort of practical National Socialism still exists. Not of the quite of the same type, naturally. But, however, in Russia, why Russia when we come to communism? Well, first of all, there's a country which had no political experience at all. They had no experience of political reality, of any of the what went on in the West. And so they developed the intelligentsia, which, remember, is a Russian word, imported, unfortunately, into this country, but not only the word, but the thing, I fear, to some extent, not only this country. And they had no experience, whatever, of real politics, of society, of community, and eventually, of course, developing the history of it, as you know, a group of them were able to take over. I've always thought the anarchist Bakunin, back in the 1870s, got the Marxists right in a way, where he said that what they want is a pedantocracy. What he meant was they want rule by a group of intellectuals consisting of them, although they wouldn't call themselves ruled intellectuals. And I think that was, to some extent, the motivation. They had their ideas, but they also had the notion of they want to take over. And this applies in a number of countries today. As you know, there are many countries where they have twice as many lawyers as can get jobs. So what are they going to do? Throw off the regime, take on an ideology, and then you'll be the Minister of Justice in the next government. I mean, one doesn't want to dismiss these irrational or hidden motives at all. Well, now in Russia. Russia then, here we come onto the real center of our problem, the question of falsifications. But I think in the intro, and you call it lies, do you? Or
falsehood.
I prefer falsification. But because, anyway, to do that part briefly, Russia, by 1929-1930, put through the regime's, the communist theory, into complete practice. They hadn't been quite able to for some years before. But they finally got control and did the collectivization of the land, of the peasantry, and the alleged industrial planning. And it was a total failure. So they were faced with the problem of what do we do? There were two methods, of course. One is to say, I'm very sorry, and resign. The other one was to say, well, we succeeded. And that is what they chose to do. In the individual cases, there were two ways of doing it. When an industry failed, you either shot the Minister of Transport, or it happened to be the Minister of Steel, because it failed, or she said it hadn't failed. There were two ways of dealing with it. But anyway, as you then had a Russia and Soviet Union, there were two sorts. There was the real one, which nobody was allowed to refer to at all, and this entirely fantasy one, which had terrific successes, both economically and spiritually and everything else. And the one which actually existed, where everybody was in a terrible state, poverty was bad, people were losing instruction, the lies were being spread and nothing could be done about it, and nothing could be said in Russia against it, not a word. In the middle of the Great Famine in 1933, if you said there was a famine, you were arrested. If you said it was the government's fault, you were shot. That solved the famine, apart from the 10 million odd who died. But this applied throughout the Soviet period. They maintained that they had correctly put into practice Marx's views, and so they had, of course, is the answer to that. They had done what Lenin and Marx had, Lenin's Marxism had foreseen. And they'd also maintained the other view that everybody who didn't accept their opinions, both foreign and home, were enemies in some sense. They maintained a state of personal, total enmity to the whole world, including communist regimes which didn't agree with them. they counted as fascist, as in Yugoslavia. But I think the actual, it's a huge subject, the sort of falsification that took place. It's almost unbelievable, the amount of extreme falsehood that was imposed on the population. The census figures were faked by several million. And of course, they were, amongst other things, the fake trials. And the falsification was, in the first place, expression of individual opinion could easily get you into trouble, and many writers were shot, or otherwise crushed. Then, as Anna Martovel, the poet, said, nobody could understand Russia who hadn't listened all the time to the Soviet radio blasting from every lamppost. It was hammered in, and even people like Sakharov felt that they'd been beaten about the head somehow. It took them years to come out from under Stalinism. And of course, the whole terror, which we're not even hardly talking about, the millions who were shot or died in camps, that everybody who was tried was tortured to produce false confessions. There was not only a false, wonderful Soviet Union, there was also a false group of horrible enemies. It was entire, total, vicious fantasy right from the start. Well, bad enough, you may say, but then we come round to what happened to the lies when they reached the West. And this is a tale of horror for all of us, that when you think of what was said or written in the 1930s by Westerners, who weren't under any compulsion to do so, about the Soviet Union, they believed almost anything. They believed the truth of the fake public trials of the 30s. They believed, in some cases, that collectivization had been a success. They even believed there wasn't a famine. Mind you, these were partly, this was reporters like Walter Duranty, who sent the New York Times his accounts of how the peasants were flourishing, though he told other people he estimated about 10 million dead. And they were printed in the West. There were two stories available in the West. One that there was a famine, another that there wasn't. And many in the West just accepted the first story without checking. And I'm tempted to go on forever on that one, but I can't go without mentioning Sidney and Beatrice Webb, the leaders, the heads of Western social science, founders of the London School of Economics, former Labour minister. And they wrote this huge book, Soviet Communism, A New Civilization. And they with a question mark in the first edition, which they took out in 1937, the worst year, they removed the question mark. And it's pure fantasy. It presents the official story. They were going around, oh, they have elections and trade unions. Well, they had, quote, elections and, quote, trade unions. But these were good enough for the Webbs. And the Webbs were not unique. There were quite a few other people did the same. People like H.G. Wells met Stalin and were so charmed by him. They said, there's a guy who isn't a dictator. He's just loved by the people. Without checking at all. Well, this died out a bit, or quite a lot, when the Nazi-Soviet pact came in 1939. But it revived, not quite in the same form, but it revived later. And even in the 80s, there were academics in the West who were denying, more or less in denial, of what had happened under Stalinism. The academics who came up during the war didn't. They'd seen what had happened. They'd been probably in the army or in political affairs somewhere, and they had first-hand experience. Then you've got a new lot who never left the corner of their university. And I can understand why they couldn't believe. It's difficult to believe what happened under Stalin. But still, if they didn't know, they shouldn't have spoken. And there are books still coming out which are highly deplorable. And when you say that I haven't had any bad reviews yet, I'm looking forward to a bit of a fight, to tell you the truth. So I'm hoping something from there. Well, so much for the effects of communism, at any rate, is still with us. Now, it's also been said, to change the theme slightly, that the intelligentsia, in the sense we've been speaking of, has emerged to some extent in the West, and that they maintain what you might call a certain similarity, even without accepting full dogmas, a tendency to accept certain matters without checking on them, and also to accept quick theories on how the state can manage everything. And I think that is also true. And I think it's also true that, of course, we get in the West, as there's no question, the state must have certain powers, and the free market must have certain powers. There's always a borderline fighting area in which the bureaucracy, which I think Robert Michel says, its failings, if it fails in the project, it doesn't affect the bureaucracy. They have another shot and recruit more people. So, and bureaucracy also, to some extent, has to, I think, have justification, in the same sense as the Soviet bureaucracy, to have justification, not quite ideological, but idea-type justification, to give it its drive. The idea of simply, nowadays, of simply having good administration is all we used to need from a bureaucracy in the old days. But that isn't good enough. You've got to be cutting edge and be going across frontiers and things. And that, of course, applies in particular to the federal Europe idea. Because there you have an idea, which sounds fine, a big idea, capital I idea, and it gives them a justification. We are going forward into the highlands of whatever it is. And what happens? You get, as you did in Russia, huge corruption with millions of dollars disappearing in Brussels. You get an incredible interference in minor matters. I mean, the British are told how their beer should be brewed, what strawberries they should have, you know, that sort of thing. But in fact, in some respects, European countries have less liberty in these matters than the American states do. This monster has developed. It's also developed on the basis, on a false basis, because there are several objections to Europe. One of it is, as I say, super bureaucratization. But the basic one is that Europe is not a potential nation. It has none of the qualifications which go to make a nation, or indeed even a group of nations. It has no any ethnic or legal or historical background to cope with it. And all these unified states like Yugoslavia and Russia and Soviet Union have proved non-starters, and I'm sure that Europe will in the end, but it's going to give trouble. But more importantly, it's divisive of the West and is implicitly and often explicitly anti-American. Now, I think this is of major importance from anyone's point of view in coping with the world as it is today. Because if we look at the world today, we cannot say we are out of danger. In my view, progress to a peaceful world is dependent on the eventual victory, isn't the word, amount of prevailing of the American, British, and so on, culture the world over. But that isn't going to be a short business. This is one of the things that affects Russia. There's a very good book on the difference between the provinces of Italy by Robert Putnam. They've had different historical experiences, and they have different attitudes to the state and to personal cooperation and so on. And of course, Russia is far more so. To take Russia alone, it'll take a long time, because we think very often, particularly in things like political science, in terms of democracy and institutions, omitting that it's not just democracy and institutions, it's habits of mind, it's custom, and these things take a long time. It can be done and will be done, no doubt, but it'll take some time, and meanwhile we are faced with great dangers. Now, how do we cope with those dangers? Well, I'm trying to stop myself saying too much about education. But first of all, we need to understand our own and the outside world in a way which I don't feel that is that the academic world here, the academic order here, has fully grasped, or to some extent the political order has not fully grasped, and has indeed been miseducated. And as Jefferson said, history should be the center of one's studies of the world, because at least you can see what happened when certain things were done. And I find that that is not followed, and if it is, the history is often distorted, let us say. And then, of course, the notion that all progress, all Western progress, is a matter entirely of conflict between various groups is not conducive to the flourishing of the Western community, and nor is the combination, I would say, of state and big capitalism into corporatism, which was, of course, objected to by Burnham. It's not so much the forms as the eroding of the consensual state, which is in question here. But when it comes to the foreign affairs, what we find ourselves, as I say, long term trying to prevail, and a lot of danger meanwhile. The first thing I think should be obvious, it doesn't seem to be obvious to everybody, is that the Western advantage in technology, and particularly in this case in arms technology, should be maintained, and made unmistakably maintained. That is to say that it should be any advances should be developed and made available to the Western governments. Not much good making your advances if you don't translate them into weaponry, because the next guy will make them and do so. But so, in my view, the West should have weapon systems unmistakably capable of preventing attacks from anybody. And that also should follow policies which are unmistakable and totally without any dubiety. I don't see that happening now, but I mean, there are certain trends in that direction. It also carries with it the notion that we are not yet in an international, a truly international balance, that we can trust everybody in the world to do the right thing if we all sign treaties with them. The signature of useless treaties is one of the most extraordinary matters before us. I mean, the Soviet Union had treaties of non-aggression with all its neighbors, and aggressed against practically all of them at various times. But we're inclined to sign a treaty and think, yeah, it sounds good, but the other people aren't going to obey it. And they wouldn't dream of keeping the treaty. If America signs a treaty, it keeps it. It puts us in the wrong. But it's not only that, it's that there is an agitation from feel-good Europeans, more than Americans, I would say, to say, oh, the Americans are being wicked, they're defending themselves. You remember the famous remark, was it Voltaire? Cet animal est très méchant, quand on l'attaque, il se défend. So the world we're into has not yet become safe, either physically or mentally. And we can do something about improving its physical safety, and we do a great deal about improving its mental safety, which I've tried to do to some extent here. I probably have about 30 questions available on every different question.